Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Wednesday, July 8th, 2026. And here are today's business headlines. Apple to spend $30 billion on U.S.-made chips from Broadcom. The deal for billions of chips is the latest part of Apple's domestic investment pledge by Rolf Winkler. Trump-backed company behind family crypto wealth in talks to sell core business. The potential sale by AI Financial marks an abrupt reversal for a company that has channeled more than $500 million to the Trumps. By Angus Berwick. Why Schmucker's $5 billion bet on the Twinkie flop. Problems arose from the snack's 65-day shelf life, as well as changing consumer habits. By Jesse Newman. White House pressures top U.S. grocers on beef prices. An Agriculture Department official spoke last week with grocers including Walmart, Kroger, and Albertsons, according to people familiar with the matter. By Patrick Thomas and Sarah Nassauer. U.S. retaliates against Iran. Plus, Bernie Sanders encourages Graham Platner to exit the Maine state race. Wall Street Journal's game shows whether you can save a penalty kick. By Zlati Mayer. Democratic lawmakers probe Lutnick's possible ties to Cantor Fitzgerald deal. The firm, previously led by the Commerce Secretary, helped USA Rare Earth raise private funds in connection with the U.S. government's investment. By Ben Glickman. Our first article today is Apple to spend $30 billion on U.S.-made chips from Broadcom. The deal for billions of chips is the latest part of Apple's domestic investments pledge. By Rolf Winkler. Apple is ramping up its investment in new U.S.-made chips, with plans to spend more than $30 billion with Broadcom in the next 5 years. The iPhone maker said Wednesday that it has forged a new deal with its longtime partner that will spur the production of more than 15 billion chips on U.S. soil. The investments is the largest Apple has specified as part of its pledge to invest $600 billion in the U.S. over 4 years, a pledge that helped the company secure an exemption from proposed Trump administration tariffs. Apple said the investment will enable Broadcom to expand a manufacturing facility in Fort Collins, Colorado. The Trump administration has made a push to encourage more manufacturing in the U.S., securing commitments from a range of big-name tech companies. The new deal with Broadcom includes radio and other chips. Apple devices have dozens of components designed to send and receive different radio signals, including 5G for data and voice transmission, GPS signals for navigation, Bluetooth for connecting to nearby devices, as well as Wi-Fi. The amount spent on the radio chips is a fraction of what Apple spends for more expensive chips inside its devices. Those components are primarily manufactured abroad, including the main logic chips that are made by Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, as well as the memory and storage chips made by companies such as Samsung and SK Hynix. The latter have exploded in price since last fall because of demand for artificial intelligence servers, prompting Apple to raise device prices. Apple has taken steps to expand its chip supply chain in the U.S., committing to buy chips from the new manufacturing facility TSMC is building in Arizona. Chip wafers from a global wafers factory in Texas that feeds the TSMC facility and others, as well as advanced chip packaging from an Amcor technology facility under construction in Arizona. Apple also recently struck a deal with Intel to make some of its chips in the U.S. Rolf Winkler is a technology reporter covering Apple for the Wall Street Journal in San Francisco. Trump-backed company behind family crypto wealth in talks to sell core business. The potential sale by AI Financial marks an abrupt reversal for a company that has channeled more than $500 million to the Trumps, by Angus Berwick. A year ago, the Trump family's crypto venture bought control of a small payments company for $750 million. The deal has been a money loser for almost everyone except the Trumps. The NASDAQ-listed company, previously called Alt 5 Sigma, and recently renamed AI Financial, is now in talks to sell its core business to blockchain technology company Perpetuals.com. According to a corporate filing, the price being discussed is up to $15 million, according to a person familiar with the transaction and company documents. The terms of the deal aren't completed and could change as negotiations continue, or the deal could fail to materialize. The potential sale would mark an abrupt reversal for a company that the Trump venture World Liberty Financial had promoted as a key to its plans to turn into a serious industry contender, harnessing dollar-based stable coins to grow an international payment business. Instead, AI Financial has served mostly to channel more than $500 million to the Trumps. In an instant of investors losing out while the presidential family rakes in cash. Last week, President Trump disclosed he had earned over $1.4 billion during the 2025 from his crypto ventures, leading to an avalanche of complaints from Democrats that he was profiting from the presidency. World Liberty acquired a majority stake in AI Financial in August by paying with its own cryptocurrency. The payments company then raised a further $750 million from investors to buy more of World Liberty's digital tokens, called WLFI. The deal saddled AI Financial with an enormous pot of Trump cryptocurrency that since has slumped 70% in value and is partly subject to a lockup. Investors in the raise have also seen their AI Financial shares fall over 90%, leaving the company's market value at just $80 million. But AI Financial's woes were set against the Trump's gain. The Trump family are entitled to 75% of the proceeds from World Liberty's sale of WLFI tokens, meaning AI Financial's purchase handed them about $540 million in cash. President Trump's disclosure identified income of $527 million from WLFI token sales, though the form didn't specify which sales these proceeds corresponded to. Spokespeople for World Liberty and AI Financial declined to comment on the deal talks. Tokyo-based Perpetuals.com said Tuesday it had signed a non-binding agreement to explore the purchase of AI Financial's payments business. White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly said all of Trump's assets are held in fully discretionary accounts managed by independent third-party and financial institutions. There are no conflicts of interest, she added. The president has implemented policies that have made all Americans wealthier and more prosperous. A Trump entity, DT Marks DEFI, of which the president owns 70%, holds a 38% stake in World Liberty. Trump's three sons are co-founders, and Trump is listed as co-founder emeritus. World Liberty CEO Zach Witkoff, son of Trump envoy Steve Witkoff, took on the role of chairman at the payments company, then known as Alt-5, at the time of the takeover. The younger Witkoff told CNBC it was an incredible company with incredible technology. Its new owners made little progress integrating World Liberty's USDI stablecoin into Alt-5's e-commerce payments platform. No USDI transactions have ever been processed on the platform, trading data on Alt-5's website show. Towards the end of last year, Alt-5 announced the departure of the chief executive, acting chief executive and chief financial officer, chief operating officer, and a board member who chaired the audit committee. In April, AI Financial rebranded from Alt-5 Sigma and said it aimed to become a financial platform for automated payments. The following month, AI Financial flagged concerns about its survival, citing a $270 million quarterly loss due to the decline in the value of its WLFI holdings and mounting debts of $39 million. AI Financial said it had drawn down $15 million under a loan agreement with World Liberty. The sale of AI Financial's payments subsidiary would now strip the company of its sole revenue-generating business, which earned $25 million last year. Under the potential deal, NASDAQ-listed Perpetuals.com would pay $5 million upfront for the subsidiary in its own stock, with a further $10 million dependent on revenue targets, according to the company documents. Perpetuals.com would also settle the payments arm's loans. Perpetuals.com, which has licenses to offer crypto products in the European Union, also agreed to explore offering World Liberty's USDI stablecoins to European investors and to license its trading engine to AI Financial, the documents show. Angus Berwick is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal in London, covering cryptocurrencies, financial crime, and markets. Why Schmucker's $5 billion bet on the Twinkie flopped. Problems arose from the snack's 65-day shelf life as well as changing consumer habits. By Jesse Newman. In 2024, Mark Schmucker, chief executive of food giant J.M. Schmucker, took the stage in an industries conference and bit into a golden, creamy Twinkie. "Tastes like growth," he said. His company had just acquired Hostess, the maker of Twinkies, in a $5 billion deal, and it seemed like a coup. The COVID-19 pandemic had supercharged America's snacking habit. Some 70% of consumers were eating at least two per day, Schmucker said. Buying the owner of Ding Dongs and Donuts gave the jam and jelly maker entry into a $65 billion market for snacks. Schmucker had beat out other suitors for Hostess, most notably General Mills. 3 years later, the deal isn't tasting quite so sweet. Sales for Schmucker's snack division, which includes Hostess, have declined for the last 6 quarters and have fallen short of the company's expectations at the time of the acquisition. Profits also tumbled during that time. In all but the latest quarter, shares of Schmucker were down 14% since the day the deal was announced in September of 2023. Over the course of the last year, Schmucker has taken 3 impairment charges tied to Hostess, totaling nearly $3 billion, and ratcheted back expectations for the brand's long-term growth. In February, Schmucker announced an agreement with activated investor Elliott Investment Management that handed the hedge fund 2 seats on the company's board. Elliott said it had become one of the company's biggest shareholders. Some problems Schmucker is facing are bedeviling other food makers. Snacking slowed as people cut discretionary spending, and weight loss drugs make the Make America Healthy Again movement gain traction. U.S. snack sales by units are down 4% in the past 4 years, according to data from market research from NIQ. Sales of sweet snacks generally have dropped 17%, the data showed. But some of the company's own making these problems. Hostess, donuts, and cupcakes, it turned out, are surprisingly unlike Schmucker jams, peanut butter, and coffee. When it folded Hostess into its business, Schmucker weakened key Hostess operating strengths tied to distribution and sales, several former and current executives and employees say. Chief Financial Officer Tucker Marshall, in a recent interview, said, "We did have some internal execution issues that we've really right-sized and worked through our last fiscal year." A 14-year veteran of Schmucker's financial operations, who now oversees Hostess, Marshall added that the company is focusing on stabilizing the business. "Really, what we've seen is just a slowdown," Marshall said, "of the sweet baked goods category. Snacking is still important. Indulgent snacking is still important." Hostess is roughly $1 billion business inside a much bigger $9 billion company, he said. "Hostess is a very important to Schmucker, but Schmucker has a total company is much larger than that." Twinkie's shelf life is considered a wonder of food science, but it tripped up Schmucker. The enriched flour, high fructose corn syrup, and tallow that make up the American classic give small sponge cake about 65 days to be consumed. Hostess had worked before the Schmucker acquisition to lengthen that shelf life. Still, 65 days is a blink of an eye compared to the shelf life of many core Schmucker products, fruit spreads, canned coffee, and dog food, which can last for at least a year. As a result, Hostess products require quicker delivery than Schmucker's. Products must turn faster through the central warehouse, and there is a greater risk that spoilage or production hiccups result in unfilled orders, executives and employees said. When Hostess was a small, standalone company, Hostess IT systems controlled every step of a Twinkie's journey, from a retailer's order to production to shipping. Schmucker's efforts to fold Hostess into its own systems stumbled, resulting in late and incomplete orders, and the current and former executives and employees have said. Previously, Hostess could be nimble if necessary. Employees could call a plant and divert a truckload of strawberry cupcakes to a store that needed more inventory. Such moves became harder under Schmucker, whose systems and longer lead times were less well-suited to more perishable items. There was another problem. Schmucker mainly serves supermarket center aisles with brands like Jif, Folgers, and Meow Mix. By contrast, some 40% of Hostess sales are in convenience stores. Schmucker separated Hostess employees who handled sales to grocery stores from those in charge of convenience stores, making it harder to forecast total demand. The current and former executives and employees say Hostess lost shelf space and display opportunities to competitors. It's just a different customer. Consumption dynamic, and an entirely different route to market. I don't think that they were prepared for, said T.D. Cohen analyst Rob Moskow of Schmucker. He said the rollout of new Hostess products slowed dramatically under Schmucker, a problem for a brand that has relied on rapid innovation. There had been booms and busts for Hostess before, including two trips to bankruptcy court. Schmucker said the company has worked on its supply chain and distribution and made improvements. It said innovation remains a focus, particularly on key brands and occasions, and that sweet baked goods broadly have had challenges hanging on to shelf space. Ultra-processed food with no protein is doing badly, said Max Gumpert, an analyst at BNP Paribas. The Twinkie business is at the center of these. Inside the Orville, Ohio company, Executives have done mea culpas, telling employees in meetings that Schmucker made mistakes in how it integrated Hostess. We've been pretty clear that we haven't been satisfied with our performance on Hostess, Schmucker, the CEO told investors at a conference last year. Some of that has been some challenges in the category in total, some with our own execution. Schmucker has been working since 2024 to turn around Hostess again. The company updated the brand's logo and packaging, launched a new market campaign targeting millennials and Gen Z consumers, and rolled out $1 packs of key donut and cake products. Schmucker says that GLP-1s have not materially impacted its Hostess business, and that consumers still want to treat themselves. It has reduced a number of Hostess products by 25% in order to focus on core brands like donuts and cupcakes, and introduced mini versions of key products to feed consumer appetite for what it called permissible indulgence. It reintroduced Susie Q's, a snack cake that resembles an ice cream sandwich, and launched Fritter Rings, which the CEO said bring a country fair kind of vibe. It also closed an Indianapolis plant to move, it said would, the move, it said, would save $30 million annually, and has worked to make its supply chain more efficient. The company said that Hostess has offered benefits to Schmucker, such as contributing to Uncrustable sales growth by enabling the brand's expansion in convenience stores. Earlier this year, Elliott and the Jam and Jelly maker struck an information-sharing agreement. Schmucker appointed two new members to its board, which the company said was focused on driving sales, profits, and disciplined capital allocation. Schmucker had already parted with several smaller brands it inherited in the Hostess deal, selling Voortman's cookies and Cloverhill packaged pastries. The efforts are starting to make a difference. Schmucker said donut sales rose 13% in its latest quarter, helped by more breakfast time purchases. In June, Schmucker's Sweet Baked Snacks division posted its first year-over-year increase in profits. Sales declines are beginning to moderate. It's going to take a bit of time until we actually see top-line growth, said Schmucker, the CEO, in a June earnings call. But suffice to say, stabilizing the business and improving profitability is where we are focused right now. Jesse Newman is a reporter covering food from the Wall Street Journal's Chicago Bureau. White House pressures top U.S. grocers on beef prices. USDA officials called grocers, including Walmart, Kroger, and Albertsons, about beef prices ahead of July 4th holiday weekend, by Patrick Thomas and Sarah Nassauer. Just days before July 4th, an Agriculture Department official called some of the country's top grocers to raise a pressing topic, lower beef prices. Tate Bennett, the chief of staff for USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins, spoke last week with grocers including Walmart, Kroger, and Albertsons, according to people familiar with the matter. She asked about their prices for beef heading into the holiday weekend, when demand for burgers on the grill is at its highest. During the USDA call with Walmart, the country's largest grocer said it already had plans to reduce prices on many items for the summer, including beef, said two of the people. Walmart implemented those plans on shelves June 29th, and later readied a press release touting the price cuts. The USDA relayed Walmart's plans to the White House, and the President Trump claimed victory Monday, posting on social media that Walmart would drop prices at my administration's request. Minutes later, Walmart published a press release saying it would drop prices on thousands of items to help customers. Ground beef atop the list of products would drop by 12%, the company said. Trump said in its post that other retailers should follow Walmart's lead. A White House spokesman said Walmart's move followed Trump administration efforts to cut regulatory red tape, slash taxes, and increase domestic food production. He said the White House stays in close contact with retailers, including making sure savings from cutting Biden-era environmental refrigerant rules go towards lowering prices for consumers. The USDA calls followed months of discussion between the Trump administration and grocers about lowering prices. The outreach effort shows how the Trump administration, facing Americans' frustration with higher prices in a midterm election year, is leaning on industries to lower costs for consumers in an unusual step for a Republican administration. Trump has separately told gasoline retailers to lower fuel prices, called for a cap on credit card interest rates, and requested pharmaceutical companies to reduce drug costs. Many companies grappling with the affordability of goods from automobiles to prescription drugs and groceries have looked for ways to keep a lid on costs to appeal to cash-starved customers and get ahead of rivals. Retailers and their suppliers also have been navigating their own higher costs arising from Trump's tariffs, and more recently, fuel prices driven higher by the Iran war. Supermarket operators Kroger and Stop and Shop owner Ahold Delhaize in recent months have touted price drops in their advertising. Other retailers have sought to lower prices to help grab market share from competitors, including Walmart, which has long emphasized lower prices as part of its marketing. In recent months, Walmart executives have shared plans to further reduce prices, particularly for grocers, in part using billions of dollars in tariff refunds that the Arkansas-based company expects to flow to its bottom line this year. "We think the single best return that we can have on a dollar of capital right now is to invest in the customer and invest in price," Walmart Chief Financial Officer John David Rainey said during the company's earnings call in May. Beef prices aren't an easy fix. The U.S. beef industry faces a years-long cattle shortage. The number of cattle on U.S. pastures has fallen to its lowest level in 75 years, after ranchers struggled with years of rising costs and drought. The declining livestock supply, combined with consumers' unflagging demand for beef, is continuing to push up prices, according to industry officials. Prices for ground beef and ribeyes have been hitting record highs this year and have helped keep food inflation in the headlines, despite falling prices for eggs and other staples. Ground beef prices in May were 12% higher than a year earlier, according to the Labor Department. Senior Trump administration officials, including Rawlins, Stephen Miller, and Peter Navarro, have been tasked by the president with finding ways to curb beef prices. Following a Truth Social post by Trump last year, the Justice Department launched a probe into the four U.S. meat packers. "The companies have denied wrongdoing. Executives have said the industry collectively has lost billions of dollars in recent years as companies process more expensive livestock." The administration also recently pledged as much as $500 million to small and mid-sized meatpacking companies to help them maintain beef production. Patrick Thomas covers agriculture and America's food supply chain for the Wall Street Journal. Sarah Nassauer writes about large retailers including Walmart, Target, Costco, Home Depot, and Dollar General for the Wall Street Journal's Corporate Bureau in New York. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org, and click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get your stream and on demand on our SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, and you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Democratic lawmakers probe Lutnick's possible ties to Cantor Fitzgerald deal. Firm previously led by Commerce Secretary helped USA Rare Earth raise private funds in connection with U.S. government's investment. By Ben Glickman. A group of Democratic lawmakers is seeking information from Cantor Fitzgerald about how the firm may have benefited on a deal from its ties with Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. In a letter to Cantor Fitzgerald Chairman Brandon Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary's son, the lawmakers raised concerns about potential violations of conflict of interest laws related to the U.S. government's $1.6 billion investment in USA Rare Earth, according to a copy of the letter viewed by the Wall Street Journal. Cantor Fitzgerald was led by Howard Lutnick for more than 30 years before he handed its ownership to his children. The firm, which had previously worked with USA Rare Earth, acted as the lead placement agent on the company's private share offering in connection with the government's investment. The letter requested information about how Cantor was selected for the assignment and any fees it collected for its role. The letter, signed by Senators Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Ron Wyden of Oregon, and Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, as well as Representative Zoe Lofgren of California, also requests other details, including about any meetings between the firm and the Commerce Department officials. A Cantor spokesman said in a statement that the firm had no role in USA Rare Earth's negotiations with or financing from the government, including anything involving the elder Lutnick. He added that Cantor has a long-standing commercial relationship with the company that predates Lutnick's government appointment. Democratic lawmakers earlier this year sent similar requests for information to the elder Lutnick and USA Rare Earth Chief Executive Barbara Hampton, seeking details of the deal. The new letter to Cantor Fitzgerald says the Commerce Secretary has refused to provide answers, leading to a broader inquiry that includes the firm. As Secretary Lutnick discussed during his congressional hearing, he nor anyone at the department has interacted with or had any discussions whatsoever with Cantor Fitzgerald regarding the rare earth minerals industry or any of the companies mentioned in this inquiry, said a Commerce Department spokesperson in a statement. Cantor Fitzgerald played no role in the award with the department. A new letter was also sent to Humpkin seeking information. The lawmakers cited Humpton's past comments about the elder Lutnick helping USA Rare Earth and asked for details on Lutnick or other Commerce Department officials' involvement in the private investment. Howard Lutnick's sons and other Cantor executives have maintained that the elder Lutnick has no knowledge of or involvement with the firm matters. In the USA Rare Earth deal, announced in January, the government agreed to supply up to $1.6 billion in loans and federal incentives for the company in exchange for a significant ownership stake. The USA Rare Earth also raised $1.5 billion in a share offering from private investors as part of the deal, according to the letter. The deal was finalized in June. Ben Glickman is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, writing about payments and regional and community banking. Our next article is There Is No Going Back, the inside story of Europe's rupture with America. Trump's tariffs, threats against Greenland, spurred a rebellion by top leaders. The Limits of Flattery Diplomacy, by Joe Parkinson's, Drew Hinshaw, and Daniel Michaels. It was almost midnight in Brussels, and the leaders of Europe were locked in their fifth hour of an emergency meeting with a single theme for discussion: how to manage a breakup with America. The new year was only 3 weeks old, and President Trump, after removing Venezuela's autocratic strongman, had briefly threatened to seize Greenland from Denmark. Around a circular table in the European Council headquarters known as the Space Egg, heads of government were venting so emotionally about the 47th president that some of the nearly 30 leaders present would later call the session therapy night. There were no cameras or recordings, and each of the presidents and prime ministers was told to come alone, no phones allowed, for a moment to speak candidly. "We're drawing a line here," began Emmanuel Macron, president of France. According to several leaders present and their most senior aides, for a year, America's closest allies had tried to placate Trump with a mix of flattery and concessions on mutual defense and trade issues, hoping to buy time. Now, French soldiers were in Greenland, alongside Danish special forces equipped for a shooting war with America. The French president repeated an argument he'd been pressing for years with mounting urgency, that Europe's over-reliance on America was a security risk. "There's no going back," he said. A clutch of European leaders chimed in to complain that the administration seemed more interested in mining and energy deals than upholding America's traditional role in the world. "Europe risked becoming a miserable slave to the U.S., groused the Prime Minister of Belgium. The conservative Prime Minister of Italy, Giorgia Meloni, dissented, telling the roomful of more liberal leaders that while they might not like President Trump, he could still be reasoned with, according to people present. To Meloni's left sat Denmark's Mette Frederiksen, trying to maintain composure. After a week of brinksmanship with Trump, the Danish Prime Minister looked so shaken that German Chancellor Friedrich Merz took a moment to ask how she was holding up. "You okay?" Hours passed as people talked over each other in conversation with such seismic implications it seemed surreal. In its 250th year, had America, protector of Europe, now become a threat? Several participants mentioned a man who wasn't in the room, Mark Carney. The new Canadian Prime Minister had been regularly massaging Europe's major leaders, messaging Europe's major leaders using a British phone number from his time in London, trying to persuade them that the old America isn't coming back. Now, on the heels of a blistering speech at the annual Davos gathering, his arguments were gaining ground. "Canada," said the Prime Minister of Spain, "is openly saying what we should do." In the months to come, the January crisis meeting would be remembered by Europe's most powerful figures as the moment that countries bound together by blood and a sense of shared destiny since the aftermath of World War II began to explore separate paths. Nobody has filed divorce papers, and important players on both sides are working hard to keep a loveless marriage going. Untangling the ties between Europe and the U.S. would be a massive undertaking. Canada, which is encouraging Europe to hedge against a more capricious America, is paradoxically much more reliant on the U.S. than almost any country on Earth. Militarily, it's hard to imagine the Allies entirely going separate ways. This week's summit of the North American Atlantic Treaty of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization will test the resolve of leaders to preserve an iconic fixture of Western might in the face of growing mutual distrust. The White House said Trump is looking forward to having constructive and frank conversations with many world leaders at the meeting in Turkey. President Trump has effectively restored America's standing in the world stage, and he's done more for NATO than anybody else, said White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly. He also believes that some NATO members should do much more to fulfill their obligations. And yet the unvarnished private talks now taking place at the commanding heights of European democracies, many reported here in detail for the first time, signal the perilous path ahead. American allies have begun pushing the gas pedal on an unprecedented experiment in de-Americanization. Authorities from France to the Netherlands are quietly removing American tech from their systems, adopting European open-source software, and urging civil servants to no longer use Microsoft Teams or Office. Belatedly, they're spending hundreds of billions of dollars to try to boost Europe's own private space firms, AI companies, and data centers to avoid leaning on U.S. juggernauts. Europeans are running studies on where they would store their data or process their payments should friction with the U.S. escalate, and how well their American-made weaponry would operate without Washington's authorization. Nations whose empires once spanned the globe are now stuck trying to extricate themselves from their humbling dependency on American technology and military power without provoking the U.S. More recent U.S. actions are only stiffening the Europeans' resolve. By the time European Council members met again at the Space Egg in March, Trump's airstrikes on Iran had spiked fuel prices across the continent, and Chancellor Merz was furious. Russia, he said, would be the only winner of the Middle East's newest war, according to leaders present. Several participants began to a wry debate over whether J.D. Vance's presidency would be preferable. Even Italy's prime minister conceded she was revising her view of the American president. Trump, Maloney lamented, is not reasonable. To understand this historic shift, the Wall Street Journal spoke to heads of government, their ministers, and top aides to reconstruct the closed-door meetings where the alliance began to splinter. The journal was able to review detailed notes taken by some participants as well as classified assessments that European intelligence agencies gave leaders struggling to navigate the new Washington. One assessment from Southern Europe reads, "You are not dealing with an administration that has processes. You're dealing with a single volatile individual." Britain's M16, struck by the climate of fear in Washington, offered Prime Minister Keir Starmer a more allegorical warning. Trump's second White House, it said, is the crucible meets Wolf Hall, referencing two fictional works about the Salem witch trials and the Court of England's ill-tempered Henry VIII. The British spy agency instructed its staff not to breach the subject of the president with their CIA counterparts. The reporting reveals the important role of Canada in molding the Allied consensus on how to deal with the new Washington. Trump's threats to make his northern neighbor America's 51st state lighted a fuse of unintended consequences that continues to burn. It brought to power Carney, a former central banker who has spent the years after 2008-09 financial crisis formulating a thesis that the West was over-reliant on a single, increasingly unpredictable country. As prime minister, he was able to start acting on this theory. With only a few allies at first, particularly France, Carney worked to persuade his fellow leaders that they faced structural dependency that couldn't be solved by appeasing Trump. His approach contrasted with that of another powerful figure, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, a veteran leader who has tried to salvage the American-led alliance in part by praising the leader at its center, a tactic the European press dubbed flattery diplomacy. The stakes couldn't be higher for the dozens of allies in between, forced to ask themselves enormous questions that remain unresolved. Will Trump's antipathy towards Europe prove particular to him or become America's new normal? Should they buy more American tech and weaponry to convince Washington of their alliance remains a boon for the U.S. economy, or build up their own and brace for a day the community known as the West unravels? It was a year earlier in February 2025, and Root was gesturing animatedly to rattled European leaders around a long chandelier-lit banquet table at Brussels' 16th-century Egmont Palace, telling them how to tackle the riddle of the newly reinaugurated Donald Trump. Just days into his sound second term, the U.S. president was threatening tariffs on Europe, and his son, Donald Trump Jr., had popped up in Greenland to pose with locals giving MAGA hats. Danish Prime Minister Frederiksen and Britain's Starmer were both in Brussels, so the leaders of the EU, UK, Denmark, and NATO could all agree on a common strategy. The conversation was private and strictly off the record. The venue had been changed at the last minute to avoid spying. Tall and telegenic, Root was chosen to lead NATO, partly because of his reputation as a Trump whisperer, who kept in friendly contact with the president after his 2020 defeat. Over lunch, Root offered a pithy proposal that would become his go-to strategy: give Trump a win. "We need to spend 3.5% on defense," he said, according to several leaders present, roughly what the U.S. shells out and far above NATO's recently achieved target of 2% of gross domestic product. Trump, for weeks, had insisted the figure should jump to 5%, a number European officials dismissed as Trump bluster, while Root's middle ground figure came from NATO military planners who studied how a war with Russia might unfold. In the language of European diplomacy, leaders took turns to both affirm and avoid the commitment. Germany said it understood the goal, yet wondered if it would make more sense to talk about what they should buy, not how much they should spend. Italy's Meloni said she would like to spend more, although public opinion was very resistant, and besides, EU budget rules wouldn't allow it. Romania's president said he also supported the sentiment, but asked, "Wouldn't this spark an arms race on the continent?" "We have no choice," Root countered. "The Allies would have to try." In his late 50s, Root was a lifelong student of indispensability of American power. His father, a prisoner of war in the Dutch East Indies, would have likely died in Japanese custody had American forces not swept through the Pacific. The longest-serving prime minister in Dutch history, Root came of age as an admirer of Ronald Reagan and believed that America's military and its nuclear umbrella would remain the ultimate guarantee of peace in the fractious continent. He virtually never took a vacation, riding his bike home late from work to practice piano. Without Washington, he argued, Europe's kaleidoscope of coalition governments in dozens of nations, many of them deeply indebted, would have to spend more than 10% of their gross domestic product just on defense, especially now that Russia's invasion of Ukraine had brought war to their doorsteps, not to mention the daunting politics of building a nuclear arsenal that could replace America's. Unanimously selected to run NATO by its member states, he said, he saw no other option than to keep America as the hub around which the West was built. To leaders who flirted with the idea of a new West without America as its linchpin, he had a response: keep on dreaming. People with visions, he liked to joke, should see a doctor. Now at the pinnacle of his career, Root told Confidence that his overriding mission was to keep NATO together by keeping Trump and the U.S. committed to it, to win some room to push back with Trump in private. Root began bombarding him with public support and praise. When texting Trump, Root would echo the president's own syntax and hyperbole, keeping his messages congratulatory with staccato sentences. He immersed himself in the role so thoroughly, some heads of government who worked with him began describing him as an actor who never broke character. Soon, European leaders were following his lead. Finland's president and Norway's prime minister started workshopping their text messages to Trump, talking about which words they should render in capital letters. Sometimes the Norwegian leader preferred his Finnish counterpart to send a message. Nordic officials worried that the mere mention of Norway, home of the Nobel Peace Prize, could reopen a sore wound. Often the Europeans played Trump's own terms back to him. When the president echoed Vladimir Putin's dislike of a ceasefire in Ukraine, they started describing their peace plan, which amounted to a ceasefire, as "stop the killing." Trump lectured top EU official Ursula von der Leyen for advocating sanctions on Russia, so she started referring to economic pressure as tariffs. A succession of leaders visited the White House, hoping to carefully mold Trump with talking points hammered out and coordinated calls to avoid any open disagreements. Weeks into Trump's second term, Macron visited to discuss NATO and Ukraine. The two spent hours together, and the U.S. president seemed open to his ideas. They used a tablet to dial into a video call led by Justin Trudeau. But as the Canadian Prime Minister was talking, Trump, frustrated with a technical issue that prevented him from chiming in, lobbed the device over the Resolute desk and onto the floor, an official president said. When Mertz visited, he was surprised to find Trump normal, an official later said. Trump listened, asked questions, seemed open to new information and knowledgeable about some topics, though surprisingly unaware of others, including the military situation in Ukraine. During their chat, Trump told Mertz he had something to show him and walked the Chancellor of Germany into a small study off the Oval Office. It was, Trump announced, the Lewinsky Room, and he had filled it with MAGA memorabilia, including red hats and boxes of Florsheim dress shoes. "Just grab whatever you want," a congenial Trump told his German guests, adding that their wives could sell the swag for thousands of dollars. Root's flattery seemed to be keeping Trump engaged with NATO until April, when Trump's new NATO ambassador, Matthew Whitaker, arrived at the alliance's Brussels headquarters with a message from Washington. 3.5% of GDP wouldn't cut it. The target was 5% by 2035, and they would need to pledge it by NATO's coming annual summit in June. NATO countries along Russia's borders saw the logic, but others were stunned. To ease the financial pain, Whitaker offered a plan under which the 3.5% for military investment could be topped up by another 1.5% of GDP for security-related investments, like airport runways, meteorological services, and cybersecurity, which countries were already forking out. Root quickly bought into the idea, reassuring holdouts. Certain bridges and tunnels could be deemed vital conduits for potential war with Russia. In private, he prodded European colleagues. The headline number was the win Trump needed. In practice, they knew no one was going to force fiscally constrained governments to meet the goal 10 years away. As NATO's 2025 summit in The Hague neared, vocal holdouts remained. Belgium and Slovakia fell in line only after Root said contributions to Ukraine could also be counted as military spending. Carney, Canada's newly elected prime minister, supported the new spending goal. Trump was right about this, he told his colleagues. The unmovable country was Spain, whose socialist prime minister Sanchez insisted the 5% was an arbitrary number. For 54 hours, NATO officials messaged back and forth with their Spanish counterparts who refused to commit to the goal, which few of his neighbors were likely to actually fulfill. Ultimately, they agreed to disagree. Root said in a letter, which Sanchez published, that Spain could follow its own sovereign path to meet targets and would be assessed in 2029. On June 24th, Trump landed at The Hague, Root's hometown, where the NATO Secretary General handed him a huge foreign policy win. The alliance, Trump said, was no longer a ripoff for the U.S. One after the next, the West's most powerful politicians took turns praising Trump in a closed-door session for strengthening the alliance he had threatened to leave. But Carney was more restrained. Trump would see through the praise, his aides reasoned, and think less of them for it. Some leaders tried to lighten the mood. The Slovenian prime minister congratulated Trump for pressuring his country to raise defense spending, saying that if anybody knew how stubborn Slovenians could be, it was the husband of Melania Trump. Trump smiled at the joke. Bulgaria's prime minister couldn't help but notice how forced the whole performance felt. There was laughter in the room, but it masked deep anxiety, said Rosen Zenislav, the then prime minister. European leaders still clung to the belief that they could manage Donald Trump through diplomatic flattery and personal charm. Weeks later, the mid-August Alaska summit between Trump and Putin set alarm bells ringing anew in Europe. Trump emerged apparently skeptical about Ukraine's chances in the war and intrigued by a Russian plan to end it on terms closer to Moscow's than Europe's. An eyes-only intelligence report circulated by a European country offered details of commercial and economic plans the Trump administration was pursuing with the Kremlin, including jointly mining rare earths in the Arctic. Francis Macron argued with an encrypted group chat that his fellow leaders that they should travel together to Washington for an urgent meeting with Trump to support Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Six European presidents and prime ministers, plus Rutte and EU's von der Leyen, filed into the White House past a string quartet, complimented the president for his strength as a negotiator as news cameras rolled. "Thank you very much, Mark," Trump said to Rutte. "You're a great leader. You're doing a fantastic job." Macron, watching on, looked uncomfortable. The White House was barely recognizable for the French president, who had served since the early months of Trump's first term. A European sisal oak sapling, taken from the World War I battlefield, which the two presidents had ceremoniously planted together in 2018 in the South Lawn, had been removed on concerns it carried parasites and died. An antechamber off Oval Office was decorated with framed magazine covers of the 47th president. The leaders sat in suspense as Trump, from another room, unexpectedly called Putin for 40 minutes. In the end, the intervention brought them only a short reprieve. Within weeks, Trump was once again expressing doubt about Ukraine's chances in entertaining a Russian peace plan that touted opportunities for U.S. businesses. The leaders realized they wouldn't be able to pin down Trump on support with the Western position in Ukraine or perhaps any other policy. "It was an excruciating experience," one person present said, and aside how little influence how America's closest allies, even traveling as a collective, exerted with the administration. The fragile consensus on flattery was starting to splinter, a trend captured by Britain's M16. That form of diplomacy, per an assessment from the spy service, was subject to a law of diminishing returns. Daniel Michaels is Brussels bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Drew Hinshaw is a senior reporter with the Wall Street Journal, who has reported from more than 50 countries for the paper since 2010. Joe Parkinson leads the Wall Street Journal's World Enterprise team, deploying to the world's biggest breaking stories and piloting deeply reported investigations. That's all the time we have for today's reading of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona.